much of a conflict, Anna thought. The Martians had made noises about independence. The UN had built a lot of ships. Mars had built a few. And then Solomon Epstein had gone from being a Martian yachting hobbyist to the inventor of the first fusion drive that solved the heat buildup and rapid fuel consumption problems of constant thrust. Suddenly, Mars had a few ships that went really, really fast. They'd said, "Hey, we're about to go colonize the rest of the solar system. Want to stay mad at us, or want to come with?" The UN had made the sensible choice, and most people would agree. Giving up Mars in exchange for a half of the solar system had probably been a pretty good deal. It didn't mean that both sides hadn't kept on designing new ways to kill each other, just in case. Just over half a kilometer long and 200 meters wide at its broadest point, the yeoman was saying. "Impressive," Anna replied, trying to bring her wandering attention back. The yeoman pulled her luggage on a small rolling cart to a bank of elevator lifts. "These elevators run the length of the ship," he said as he punched a button on the control panel. "We call them the keel elevators." "Because they run along the belly of the ship?" Anna said. "Yes, that's what the bottom of seagoing vessels was called, and space-based navies have kept the nomenclature." Anna nodded. His enthusiasm was exhausting and charming at the same time. He wanted to impress her, so she resolved to be impressed. It was a small enough thing to give someone. "Of course, the belly of the ship is largely an arbitrary distinction," he continued as the elevator climbed. "Because we use thrust gravity, the deck is always in the direction thrust is coming from, the aft of the ship. Up is always away from the engines. There's not really much to distinguish the other four directions from each other. Some smaller ships can land on planetary surfaces, and in those ships the belly of the ship contains landing gear and thrusters for liftoff." "I imagine the Prince is too large for that," Anna said. "By quite a lot, actually. But our shuttles and corvettes are capable of surface landings, though it doesn't happen very often." The elevator doors opened with another ding, and the yeoman pushed her luggage out into the hall. "After we drop off your baggage at your stateroom, we can continue the tour." "Yeoman," Anna said, "is that the right way to address you?" "Certainly, or Mr. Ichigawa, or even Jin, since you're a civilian." "Jin," Anna continued, "would it be all right if I just stayed in my room for a while? I'm very tired." He stopped pulling her baggage and blinked twice. "But the captain said all of the VIP guests should get a complete tour, including the bridge, which is usually off limits to non-duty personnel." Anna put a hand on the boy's arm. "I understand that's quite a privilege, but I'd rather see it when I can keep my eyes open. You understand, don't you?" She gave his arm a squeeze and smiled her best smile at him. "Certainly," he said, smiling back. "Come this way, ma'am." Looking around her, Anna wasn't sure if she actually wanted to see the rest of the ship. Every corridor looked the same. Slick, gray material with something spongy underneath covered most walls. Anna supposed it was some sort of protective surface to keep sailors from injury if they banged into it during maneuvers. And anything that wasn't gray fabric was gray metal. The things that would be impressive to most people about the ship would be its various mechanisms for killing other ships. Those were the parts of the ship she was least interested in. "Is that okay?" Ichigawa said after a moment. Anna had no idea what he was talking about. "Calling you ma'am, I mean. Some of the VIPs have titles. Pastor or reverend or minister. I don't want to offend." "Well, if I didn't like you, I'd ask you to call me Reverend Doctor. But I do like you very much, so please don't," she said. "Thank you," Jin said, and the back of his neck blushed. "And if you were a member of my congregation, I'd have you call me Pastor Anna." "Buddhist?" "Only when I'm at my grandmother's house," Jin said with a wink. The rest of the time, I'm a Navy man. Is that a religion now? Anna asked with a laugh. The Navy thinks so. Okay, she laughed again. So why don't you just call me Anna? Yes, ma'am, Jin said. He stopped at a gray door marked OQ-297-11 and handed her a small metal card. This is your room. Just having the card on you unlocks the door. It will stay locked when you're inside unless you press the yellow button on the wall panel. Sounds very safe, Anna said, taking the key from Jin and shaking his hand. This is the battleship Thomas Prince, ma'am. It's the safest place in the solar system. Her stateroom was 3 meters wide by 4 meters long. Luxurious by Navy standards, normal for a poor Europan, coffin-like to an earther. Anna felt a brief moment of vertigo as the two different Annas she'd been reacted to the space in three different ways. She'd felt the same sense of disconnection when she'd first boarded the Prince, and felt the full gravity pressing her down. The earther she'd been most of her life felt euphoric, as for the first time in years, her weight felt right. The Europan in her just felt tired, drained by the excessive pull on her bones. She wondered how long it would take Nono to get her earth legs back, how long it would take before Nami could walk there. They were both spending the entire trip back pumped full of muscle and bone growth stimulators, but drugs can only take a person so far. There would still be the agonizing weeks or months as their bodies adapted to the new gravity. Anna could almost see little Nami struggling to get up onto her hands and knees like she did on Europa. Could almost hear her cries of frustration while she built up the strength to move on her own again. She was such a determined little thing. It would infuriate her to lose the hard-won physical skills she developed over the last 2 years. Thinking about it made Anna's chest ache, just behind her breastbone. She tapped the shiny black surface of the console in her room, and the room's terminal came on. She spent a moment learning the user interface. It was limited to browsing the ship's library and to sending and receiving text or audio-video messages. She tapped the button to record a message and said, "Hi, Nono. Hi, Nami." She waved at the camera. "I'm on the ship, and we're on our way. She stopped and looked around the room, at the sterile gray walls and Spartan bed. She grabbed a pillow off of it and turned back to the camera. "I miss you both already." She hugged the pillow to her chest tight. "This is you. This is both of you." She turned the recording off before she got teary. She was washing her face when the console buzzed a new message alert. Even though it didn't seem possible Nami could have gotten the message and replied already, her heart gave a little leap. She rushed over and opened the message. It was a simple text message reminding her of the VIP meet and greet in the officer's mess at 1900 hours. The clock said it was currently 1300. Anna tapped the button to RSVP to the event, and then climbed under the covers of her bed with her clothes on, and cried herself to sleep. "Reverend Dr. Volovodov," a booming male voice said as soon as she walked into the officer's mess. The room was laid out for a party, with tables covered in food ringing the room, and 100 or more people talking in loose clumps in the center. In one corner, an ad hoc bar with 4 bartenders was doing brisk business. A tall, dark-skinned man with perfectly coiffed white hair and an immaculate gray suit walked out of the crowd like Venus rising from the waves. Anna wondered how he managed the effect. He reached out and took her hand with his. "I'm so happy to have you with us. I've heard so much about the powerful work you're doing on Europa, and I don't see how the Methodist World Council could have chosen anyone else for this important trip." Anna shook his hand, then carefully extricated herself from his grasp. "Dr. Hector Cortez, Father Hank," on his live streamcasts that went out to over 100 million people each week, and close personal friend and spiritual advisor to the Secretary General himself. She couldn't imagine how he knew anything about her. Her tiny congregation of less than 100 people on Europa wouldn't even be a rounding error to his solar system-wide audience. She found herself caught between feeling flattered, uncomfortable, and vaguely suspicious. "Dr. Cortez," Anna said, "so nice to meet you. I've seen your show before, of course." "Of course," he said, smiling vaguely, and already looking around the room for someone else to talk to. She had the sense that he'd come to greet her less out of the pleasure of her arrival than as a chance to extricate himself from whatever conversation he'd been having before, and she didn't know whether to be relieved or insulted. She settled on amused. Like a smaller object dragged into some larger gravity well, an elderly man in formal Roman Catholic garb pulled away from the central crowd and drifted in Dr. Cortez's direction. She started to introduce herself when Dr. Cortez cut in with that booming voice and said, "Father Michel, say hello to my friend Reverend Dr. Anushka Volovidov, a worker for God's glory with the Europa Congregation of Methodists." "Reverend Volovidov," the Catholic man said, "I'm Father Michel, with the Archdiocese of Rome." "Oh, very nice to meet," Anna started. "Don't let him fool you with that humble old country priest act," Cortez boomed over the top of her. "He's a bishop on the short list for cardinal."
"Congratulations," Anna said.
"Oh, it's nothing. All exaggeration and smoke," the old man beamed. "Nothing will happen until it fits with God's plan." "You wouldn't be here if that were true," Cortez said. The bishop chuckled. A woman in an expensive blue dress followed one of the uniformed waiters with his tray of champagne. She and Father Michel reached for a glass at the same moment. Anna smiled a no at the offered champagne, and the waiter vanished into the crowd at the center of the room. "Please," the woman said to Anna, "don't leave me to drink alone with a Catholic. My liver can't take it."
"Thank you, but
what about you, Hank? I've heard you can put down a few drinks." She punctuated this with a swig from her glass. Cortez's smile could have meant anything.
"I'm Anna," Anna said, reaching out to shake the woman's hand. "I love your dress."
"Thank you." "I am Mrs. Robert Fagan," the woman replied with mock formality. "Tilly, if you aren't asking for money."
"Nice to meet you, Tilly," Anna said.
"I'm sorry, but I don't drink." "God save me from temperance," Tilly said. "You haven't seen a party till you get a group of Anglicans and Catholics trying to beat each other to the bottom of a bottle."
"No, that's not nice, Mrs. Fagan," Father Michel said. "I've never met an Anglican who could keep up with me."
"Hank, why is Esteban letting you out of his sight?"
It took Anna a moment to realize that Tilly was talking about the Secretary General of the United Nations. Cortez shook his head and feigned a wounded look without losing his ever-present toothy grin.
"Mrs. Fagan, I'm humbled by the Secretary General's faith and trust in me as we speed off toward the single most important event in human history since the death of our Lord."
Tilly snorted. "You mean his faith and trust in the 100 million voters you can throw his way in June?" "Ma'am," Cortez said, turning to look at Tilly's face for the first time. His grin never changed, but something chilled the air between them. "Maybe you've had a bit too much champagne."
"Oh, not nearly enough."
Father Michel charged in to the rescue, taking Tilly's hand and saying,
"I think our dear Secretary General is probably even more grateful for your husband's many campaign contributions. Though that does make this the most expensive cruise in history for you."
Tilly snorted and looked away from Cortez. "Robert can fucking afford it." The obscenity created an awkward silence for a few moments, and Father Michel gave Anna an apologetic smile. She smiled back, so far out of her depth that she'd abandoned trying to keep up.
What's he getting with them, I wonder? Tilly said, pointing attention at anyone other than herself. These artists and writers and actors. How many votes does a performance artist bring to the table? Do they even vote?
It's symbolic, Father Michel said, his face taking on a well-practiced expression of thoughtfulness. We are all of humanity coming together to explore the great question of our time. The secular and the divine come to stand together before that overwhelming mystery. What is the ring?
Nice, Tilly said. Rehearsal pays off.
Thank you, the bishop said.
What is the ring? Anna said with a frown.
It's a wormhole gate.
There's no question, right? We've been talking about these on a theoretical basis for centuries. They look just like this. Something goes through it, and the place on the other side isn't here. We get the transmission signals bleeding back out and attenuating. It's a wormhole.
That's certainly a possibility, Father Michel said.
Tilly smiled at the sourness in his voice. How do you see our mission here, Anna?
It isn't what it is that's at issue, she said, glad to be back in a conversation she understood. It's what it means. This changes everything, and even if it's something wonderful, it'll be displacing. People will need to understand how to fit this in with their understanding of the universe, of what this means about God, what this new thing tells us about Him. By being here, we can offer comfort that we couldn't otherwise.
I agree, Cortez said. Our work is to help people come to grips with the great mysteries, and this one's a doozy.
No, Anna started. Explaining isn't what I...
Play your cards right, and it might get Esteban another 4 years, Tilly said over the top of her. Then we can call it a miracle.
Cortez grinned a white grin at someone across the room. A man in a small group of men and women in loose orange robes raised his hand, waving at them.
Can you believe those people? Tilly asked.
I believe those are delegates from the Church of Humanity Ascendant, Anna said.
Tilly shook her head. Humanity Ascendant? I mean, really? Let's just make up our own religion and pretend we're the gods.
Careful, Cortez said. They're not the only ones.
Seeing Anna's discomfort, Father Michel attempted to rescue her.
Dr. Volovodov, I know the elder of that group. Wonderful woman. I'd love to introduce you, if you all would excuse us.
Excuse me, Anna started, then stopped when the room suddenly went silent. Father Michel and Cortez were both looking towards something at the center of the gathering near the bar, and Anna moved around Tilly to get a better view. It was hard to see at first, because everyone in the room was moving away toward the walls. But eventually, a young man dressed in a hideous bright red suit was revealed. He'd poured something all over himself. His hair and the shoulders of his jacket were dripping a clear fluid onto the floor. A strong alcohol scent filled the room.
This is for the People's Ashtun Collective, the young man yelled out in a voice that trembled with fear and excitement. Free Etienne Barbara, and free the Afghan people.
Oh, dear God, Father Michel said. He's going to...
Anna never saw what started the fire, but suddenly the young man was engulfed in flames. Tilly screamed. Anna's shocked brain only registered annoyance at the sound. Really, when had someone screaming ever solved a problem? She recognized her fixation on this irritation as her own way of avoiding the horror in front of her, but only in a distant and dreamy sort of way. She was about to tell Tilly to just shut up when the fire suppression system activated and 5 streams of foam shot out of hidden turrets in the walls and ceiling. The fiery man was covered in white bubbles and extinguished in seconds. The smell of burnt hair competed with the alcohol stench for dominance. Before anyone else could react, naval personnel were streaming into the room. Stern-faced young men and women with holstered sidearms calmly told everyone to remain still while emergency crews worked. Medical technicians came in and scraped foam off the would-be suicide. He seemed more surprised than hurt. They handcuffed him and loaded him onto a stretcher. He was out of the room in less than a minute. Once he was gone, the people with guns seemed to relax a little. "They certainly put him out fast," Anna said to the armed young woman closest to her. "That's good." The young woman, looking hardly older than a schoolgirl, laughed. "This is a battleship, ma'am. Our fire suppression systems are robust." Cortez had darted across the room and was speaking to the ranking naval officer in a booming voice. He sounded upset. Father Michel seemed to be quietly praying, and Anna felt a strong urge to join him. "Well," Tilly said, waving at the room with her empty champagne glass. Her face was pale, apart from two bright red dots on her cheeks. "Maybe this trip won't be boring after all." Chapter 9. Bull. It would have gone faster if Bull had asked for more help, but until he knew who was doing what, he didn't want to trust too many people, or anyone. 1,000 people in the crew more or less made things a little muddier than they would have been in some ways. With a crew that big, the security chief could look for things like crew members from unlikely departments meeting up at odd times, deviations from the pattern that every ship had. Since this was the shakedown voyage, the Behemoth didn't have any patterns yet. It was still in a state of chaos, crew and ship getting to know one another, making decisions, forming habits and customs and culture. Nothing was normal yet, and so nothing was strange. On the other hand, it was only 1,000 people. Every ship had a black economy. Someone on the Behemoth would be trading sex for favors. Someone would run a card game or set up a pachinko parlor or start a little protection racket. People would be bribed to do things or not do things. It was what happened when you put people together. Bull's job wasn't to stamp it all out. His job was to keep it at a level that kept the ship moving and safe, and to set boundaries. Alexei Meyerson Freud was a nutritionist. He'd worked mid-level jobs on Tycho, mostly in the yeast vats, tuning the bioengineering to produce the right mix of chemicals, minerals, and salts for keeping humans alive. He'd been married twice, had a kid he hadn't seen in 5 years, was part of a network wargaming group that simulated ancient battles, pitting themselves against the great generals of history. He was 8 years younger than Bull. He had mouse-ass brown hair, an awkward smile, and a side business selling a combination stimulant and euphoric the Belters called pixie dust. Bull had worked it all until he was certain. And even once he had, he'd waited a few days. Not long. Just enough that he could follow Alexei around on the security system. He needed to make sure there wasn't a bigger fish above him, a partner who was keeping a lower profile or a connection to Bull's own team. Or else, God forbid, Ashford's. There wasn't. Truth was, he didn't want to do it. He knew what had to happen, and it was always easier to put it off for another 15 minutes, or until after lunch, or until tomorrow. Only every time he did, it meant someone else was going on shift stoned, maybe making a stupid mistake, breaking the ship, getting injured, or getting killed. The moment came in the middle of second shift. Bull turned down his console, stood up, took a couple of guns from the armory, and made a connection on his hand terminal.
"Serge."
"Boss?"
"I'm gonna need you and one other. We're going to go bust a drug dealer."
The silence on the line sounded like surprise. Bull waited. This would tell him something, too. You got it, Serge said. Be right there. Serge came into the office 10 minutes later with another security grunt, a broad-shouldered, grim-faced woman named Corin. She was a good choice. Bull made a mental note in Serge's favor and handed them both guns. Corin checked the magazine, holstered it, and waited. Serge flipped his from hand to hand, judging the weight and feel, then shrugged.
What's the plan?
He asked.
Come with me, Bull said. Someone tries to keep me from doing my job, warn them once, then shoot them.
Straightforward, Serge said, and there was a sense of approval in the word. The food processing complex was deep inside the ship, close to the massive, empty inner surface. In the long voyage to the stars, it would have been next to the farmlands of the small internal world of the Nauvoo. In the behemoth, it wasn't anywhere in particular. What had been logical became dumb, and all it took was changing the context. Bull drove them, the little electric carts, foam wheels buzzing against the ramps. In the halls and corridors, people stopped, watched. Some stared. It said something that three armed security agents traveling together stood out. Bull wasn't sure it was something good. Near the vats, the air smelled different. There were more volatiles and unfiltered particulates. The processing complex itself was a network of tubs and vats and distilling columns. Half of the place was shut down, the extra capacity mothballed and waiting for a larger population to feed, or else waiting to be torn out. They found Alexei knee-deep in one of the water treatment baths, orange rubber waders clinging to his legs and his hands full of thick green kelp. Bull pointed to him, and then to the catwalk on which he, Serge, and Corin stood. There might have been a flicker of unease in Alexei's expression. It was hard to say.
I can't get out right now, the dealer said, holding up a broad, wet leaf. I'm in the middle of something.
Bull nodded and turned to Serge.
You two stay here. Don't let him go anywhere. I'll be right back.
Sasa, boss, Serge said.
The locker room was down a ladder and through a hall. The bank of pea-green private storage bins had been pulled out of the wall, turned 90 degrees, and put back in to match the direction of thrust. Blobs and filaments of caulk still showed at the edges where it failed to sit quite flush. Two other water processing techs were sitting on the bench in different levels of undress, talking and flirting. They went silent when Bull walked in. He smiled at them, nodded, and walked past to a locker on the far end. When he reached it, he turned back.
This belonged to anyone? He asked.
The two techs looked at each other.
No, sir, the woman said, pulling her jumpsuit a little more closed. Most of these are just empty.
Okay, then, Bull said.
He thumbed in his override code and pulled the door open. The duffel bag inside was green and gray, the kind of thing he'd have put his clothes in when he went to work out. He ran a finger along the seal. About 100 vials of yellow-white powder, a little more grainy than powdered milk. He closed the bag, put it on his shoulder.
Is there a problem? The male tech asked.
His voice was tentative, but not scared. Curious more. Excited. Well, God loved rubberneckers, and so did Bull.
Myers and Freud just stopped selling pixie dust on the side, Bull said. Should go tell all your friends, eh?
The techs looked at each other, eyebrows raised, as Bull headed out. Back at the kelp tank, he dropped the bag, then pointed to Alexei and to the catwalk beside him, the same motions he'd used before. This time, Alexei's face went grim. Bull waited while the tech slogged through the deep water and pulled himself up.
What's the problem? Alexei said. What's in the bag?
Bull shook his head slowly, and only once. The chagrin on Alexei's face was like a confession. Not that Bull had needed one.
Hey, Ese, Bull said. Just want you to know I'm sorry about this.
He punched Alexei in the nose. Cartilage and bone gave way under his knuckle, and a bright red fountain of blood spilled slowly past the tech's startled mouth.
Put him on the back of the cart, Bull said, where folks can see him.
Serge and Corin exchanged a look that was a lot like the pair in the locker room.
We heading to the brig, boss?
Serge asked, and his tone of voice meant he already knew the answer.
We have a brig?
Bull asked as he scooped up the duffel bag.
Pretty don't.
Then we're not going there.
Bull had planned the route to pass through all the most populated public areas between the innermost areas of the ship and its skin. Word was already going around, and there were spectators all along the way. Alexei was making a high, keening sound when he wasn't shouting or begging or demanding to see the captain. Bull had the sudden, visceral memory of seeing a pig carried to the slaughter when he'd been younger. He didn't know when it had happened. The memory was just there, floating unconnected from the rest of his life. It took almost half an hour to reach the airlock. A crowd had gathered, a small sea of faces, most of them on wide heads and thin bodies. The belters watching the earther kill one of their own. Bull ignored them. He keyed in his passcode, opened the inner door of the lock, walked back to the cart, and hefted Alexei with one arm. In the low gravity, it should have been easy, but Bull felt himself getting winded before he got back to the lock. It didn't help that Alexei was thrashing. Bull pushed him in, closed the inner door, put in the override code and opened the exterior door without evacuating the air first. The pop rang through the metal deck like a distant bell. The monitor showed that the lock was empty. Bull closed the exterior door. While the lock refilled, he walked back to the cart. He stood on the back of the cart where Alexei had been, the duffel bag over his head in both hands. Blood stained his sleeve and his left knee.
This is pixie dust, right? He said to the crowd.
He didn't use his terminal to amplify his voice. He didn't need to.
I'm going to leave this in the airlock for 16 hours. Then I'm spacing it. Any other dust comes in to join it before then? Well, it just happened. No big deal. Any of this goes away, and that's a problem. So, everybody go tell everybody. And the next pendejo signs on shift high, comes and talks to me.
He walked back to the airlock slowly, letting everyone see him. He opened the inner door, slung the bag through, and turned away, leaving the door open behind him. Climbing back behind the wheel of the cart, he could feel the tension in the crowd, and it didn't bother him at all. Other things did. What he'd just done was the easy part. What came next was harder, because he had less control over it.
You want to set a guard on that, boss?
Serge asked.
Think we need to?
Bull asked. He didn't expect an answer, and he didn't get one. The cart lurched forward, the spectators parting before it like a herd of antelope before a lion. Bull aimed them back toward the ramps that would take him to the security offices.
Hardcore, Corin said.
She made it sound like a good thing. Religious art decorated the captain's office. Angels in blue and gold held the parabolas of the archways that rose overhead to meet the image of a calm and bearded god. A beneficent Christ looked down from the wall behind Ashford's desk, Caucasian features, calm and serene. He didn't look anything like the bloody, bent, crucified man Bull was familiar with. Arrayed at the Savior's side were images of plenty. Wheat, corn, goats, cows, and stars. Captain Ashford paced back and forth by Jesus' knees, his face dark with blood and fury. Michio Pa was seated in the other guest chair, carefully not looking at Ashford or at Bull. Whatever the situation was with the Martian science ships and their military escort, with the massive Earth flotilla, it was forgotten for the moment. Bull didn't let the anxiety show in his face.
"This is unacceptable, Mr. Baca."
"Why do you think that, sir?"
Ashford stopped, put his wide hands on the desk and leaned forward. Bull looked into his bloodshot eyes and wondered whether the captain was getting enough sleep.
"You killed a member of my crew," Ashford said. "You did it with clear premeditation. You did it in front of 100 witnesses."
"Shit, you want witnesses, there's surveillance footage," Bull said. It wasn't the right thing to do.
"You are relieved of duty, Mr. Baca, and confined to quarters until we return to Tycho Station, where you will stand trial for murder."
"He was selling drugs to the crew."
"Then he should have been arrested."
Bull took a deep breath, exhaling slowly through his nose.
"You think we're more running a warship or a space station, sir?" he asked.
Ashford's brow furrowed, and he shook his head. To Bull's right, Pa shifted in her seat. When neither of them spoke, Bull went on.
"Reason I ask is, if I'm a cop, then yeah, I should have taken him to the brig, if we had a brig. He should have gotten a lawyer. We could have done that whole thing."
"Me? I don't think this is a station. I think it's a battleship. I'm here to maintain military discipline in a potential combat zone. Not Earth Navy discipline. Not Martian Navy discipline. OPA discipline. The Belter way."
Ashford stood up.
"We aren't anarchists," he said, his voice dripping with scorn.
"OPA tradition, maybe I'm wrong, is that someone does something that intentionally endangers the ship, they get to hitchhike back to wherever there's air," Bull said.
"You hauled him out of a water vat. How was he endangering the ship? Was he going to throw kelp at it?"
Pa said, her voice brittle.
"People been coming on shift high," Bull said, lacing his fingers together on one knee. "Don't trust me? Ask around. And come on, of course they are, right? We've got 3 times as much work needs to get done as we can do. Pixie dust and they don't feel tired. Don't take breaks. Don't slow down. Get more done. Thing about bad judgment? You gotta have good judgment to notice you've got it. We already got people hurt. Matter of time before someone died. Or worse.
You're saying this man was responsible for all those other people performing badly at their work, so you killed him?"
Ashford said. But the wind was out of his sails. He was going to fold like wet cardboard. Bull recognized that Ashford's weakness was going to work to his advantage this time, but he still hated it.
"I'm saying he was putting the ship at risk for his own financial gain, just like he was stealing air filters. And sure he did. There was a demand, he filled it. If I lock him up, that makes it so that the risk is higher. Prices are higher. Get caught, you maybe go to jail when we get back to Tycho."
"And you made it so that the risk is death?"
"No," Bull said. "I mean, yeah, but I don't shoot him. I do what you do to people who risk the ship. Belters know what getting spaced means, right? It frames the issue.
This was a mistake.
I've got a list of 50 people he sold to," Bull said. "Some of them are skilled technicians.
A couple are mid-level overseers. We could lock them all up, but then we've got less people to do the work. And anyway, they won't be doing it anymore. Supply's gone. But if you want, I could talk to them. Let them know I'm keeping an eye open. Pa's chuckle was mirthless. That would be difficult if you're in the brig on charges, she said.
We don't have a brig, Bull said.
Plan was the church elders were just gonna talk everything out. He kept his tone carefully free of sarcasm. Ashford waffled. It was like watching a cat trying to decide whether to jump from one tree limb to another. His expression was calculating, internal, uncertain. Bull waited.
This never happens again, Ashford said. You decide someone needs to go out the airlock, you come to me. I'll be the one that pushes the button.
All right?
All right what? Ashford bit the words.
Bull lowered his head, looking at the deck. He'd gotten what he came for. He could let Ashford feel like he'd gotten a little win, too.
I mean, yes, sir, Captain. Solid copy. I understand and will comply.
You're damn right you will, Ashford said. Now get the hell back to work.
Yes, sir.
When the door closed behind him, Bull leaned against the wall and took a few deep breaths. He was intensely aware of the sound of the ship, low hum of the air recyclers, the distant murmur of voices, the chimes and beeps of 1,000 different system alerts. The air smelled of plastic and ozone. He'd taken his calculated risk, and he'd pulled it off. Walking back down, level by level, he felt the attention on him. In the lift, a man tried not to stare at him. In the hall outside the security office, a woman smiled at him and nodded, nervous as a mouse that smells cat. Bull smiled back. In the security office, Serge and another man from the team, a Europan named Casimir, lifted their fists, greeting him in the physical idiom of the belt. Bull returned the gesture and ambled over.
What we got? Bull asked.
A couple dozen people came to pay respects, Serge said. I figure about 0.5 kilo more dust just appeared out of nowhere.
Okay, then.
I've got a file of everyone who went in. You want me to flag them in the system?
Nope, Bull said.
I told them it was no big deal. It's no big deal. You can kill the file.
You got it, boss.
I'll be in my office, Bull said. Let me know if something comes up, and somebody start a pot of coffee. He sat down on the desk, his feet resting on the seat of his chair, and leaned forward. He was suddenly exhausted. It had been a long, bad day, and losing the dread he'd been carrying for weeks leading up to it was like being released from prison. It took a minute or two to notice he had a message waiting from Michio Pa. The XO hadn't requested a connection. She didn't want to talk to him then. She just wanted to say something. In the recording, her face was lit from below with the backsplash of her hand terminal screen. Her smile was thin and tight and sort of faded away somewhere around her cheekbones. I saw what you did there. That was very nice, very clever. Wrapping yourself in the OPA flag, making the old man wonder if the crew wouldn't take your side. More belter than thou. It was graceful. Bull scratched his chin. The stubble that had grown in since morning made his fingernails sound like a rasp. It was probably too much to ask that he not make any enemies with this. But he was sorry it was Pa. You can't sugarcoat it with me. We both know that killing someone doesn't make you admirable. I'm not about to forget this. I just hope you have enough soul left that what you've done still bothers you. The recording ended, and Bull smiled at the blank screen wearily. Every time, he told the hand terminal. And next time, too.
Chapter 10. Holden. The Rosinante was not a small ship. Her normal crew complement was over a dozen Navy personnel and officers, and on many missions she'd also carry 6 Marines. Running the Rosi with 4 people meant each of them did several jobs, and that didn't leave a lot of downtime. It also meant that it was pretty easy, at first, to avoid the 4 strangers living on the ship. With a documentary crew restricted from entering ops, the airlock deck, the machine shop, or engineering, they were stuck on the 2 crew decks with access only to their quarters, the head, the galley, and sickbay. Monica was a lovely person. Calm, friendly, charismatic. If even a part of her charm translated to the other side of the camera, it was easy to see how she'd succeeded. The others, Okju, Clip, Cohen, made clear overtures of friendship, cracking jokes with the Rosinante's crew, making dinners. Reaching out. But it wasn't clear to Holden whether it was the usual honeymoon period that came when any crew first came together for a long voyage, or something more calculated. Maybe a little of both. What he did see was his own crew drawing back. After 2 days of the documentary team being on board, Naomi simply retreated to the ops deck where she couldn't be found. Amos had made a half-hearted pass at Monica and a slightly more serious attempt with Okju. When both failed, he began spending most of his time in the machine shop. Of them all, only Alex took time to socialize with their passengers, and him not all that often. He'd taken to sometimes sleeping in the pilot's couch. They'd agreed to being interviewed, and Holden knew they couldn't avoid it forever. They hadn't been out for a full week yet, and even on a fairly high burn would be months to their destination. Besides, it was in their contract. The discomfort of it was almost enough to distract him from the fact that every day brought them closer to the ring, and whatever it was that Miller wanted him out there for. Almost. It's Saturday, Naomi said. She was lounging in a crash couch near the comm station. She hadn't cut her hair for a while, and it was getting long enough to become an annoyance to her. For the last 10 minutes, she'd been trying to braid it. The thick, black curls resisted her efforts, seeming to move with a will of their own. Based on past experience, Holden knew this was the precursor to cutting half of it off in exasperation. Naomi liked the idea of growing her hair very long, but not the reality. Holden sat at the combat ops panel, watching her struggle with it and letting his mind drift. Did you hear me? She said. It's Saturday. Are we inviting our guests to dinner? It had become custom on the ship that no matter what else was going on, the crew tried to have dinner as a group once a week. By unspoken agreement, it was usually Saturday. Which day of the week it happened to be didn't really matter much on a ship, but by holding their dinner on Saturday, Holden thought they were doing some small bit to celebrate the passing of a week. The beginning of another. A gentle reminder that there was still a solar system outside the 4 of them. But he hadn't considered inviting the documentary crew to join them. It felt like an invasion. The Saturday dinner was for crew. We can't keep them out of it, he sighed. Can we? Not unless we want to eat up here. You did give them the run of the galley. Damn it, he said. Should have confined them to quarters. For 4 months? We could have shoved ration bars and catheter bags under the door to them. She smiled and said, It's Amos's turn to cook. Right. I'll call and let him know it's dinner for 8. Amos made pasta and mushrooms, heavy on the garlic, heavy on the parmesan. It was his favorite,
and he always splurged to buy real cloves of garlic and actual Parmesan cheese to grate. Another small luxury they wouldn't be able to afford if they wound up in a courtroom battle with Mars. While Amos finished sautéing the mushrooms and garlic, Alex set the table and took drink orders. Holden sat next to Naomi on one side of the table, while the documentary crew sat together on the other. The banter was polite and friendly, and if there was an uncomfortable undercurrent to it all, he still wasn't quite sure why. Holden had asked them not to bring cameras or recording equipment to the dinner table, and Monica had agreed. Clip, the Martian, was talking about sports history with Alex. Okju and Cohen, sitting across from Naomi, were telling stories about the last assignment they'd been on, covering a new scientific station that was in stationary orbit around Mercury. It should have been almost pleasant, and it just wasn't. Holden said, "We don't usually eat this well while flying, but we try to do something nice for our weekly dinner together." Okju smiled and said, "Smells lovely." She was wearing half a dozen rings, a blouse with buttons on it, a silver pendant, and an ivory-colored comb holding back her frizzy brown hair. The sound man gazed serenely at nothing, his black glasses hiding the top of his face, his expression calm and open. Monica watched him look over her crew, saying nothing, a faint smile on her lips. "Ciao," Amos said, then began putting bowls of food on the table. While the meal was handed around in a slow circuit, Okju bowed her head and mumbled something. It took Holden a moment to realize she was praying. He hadn't seen anyone do it for years, not since he'd left home. One of his fathers, Caesar, had sometimes prayed before meals. Holden waited for her to finish before he started eating. "This is very nice," Monica said. "Thank you."
"You're welcome," said Holden.
"We're a week out of series," she said, "and I think we're all settled in. Was wondering if we could start scheduling some preliminary interviews? It's mostly so we can test out the equipment."
"You can interview me," Amos said, not quite hiding his leer.
Monica smiled at him and speared a mushroom with her fork, then stared at him while she popped it into her mouth and chewed slowly. "Okay," she said. "We can start with background work. Baltimore?" The silence was suddenly brittle. Amos started to stand, but a gentle hand on his arm from Naomi stopped him. He opened his mouth, closed it, then looked down at his plate while the pale skin on his scalp and neck turned bright red. Monica looked down at her plate, her expression at the friction point between embarrassed and annoyed.
"That's not a good idea," Holden said.
"Captain, I'm sensitive to privacy issues for you and your crew, but we have an agreement. And with all respect, you've been treating me and mine like we're unwelcome." Around the table, the food was starting to cool off. It had hardly been touched.
"I get it. You held up your end of the deal," Holden said. "You got me off series, and you put money in our pockets. We haven't been holding up our end. I get it. I'll set aside an hour tomorrow for starters. Does that work?"
"Sure," she said. "Let's eat."
"Baltimore, huh?" Clip said to Amos. "Football fan?"
Amos said nothing, and Clip didn't press it. After the uncomfortable dinner, Holden wanted nothing more than to climb into bed. But while he was in the head brushing his teeth, Alex pretended to casually wander in and said,
"Come on up to Ops, Cap. Got something to talk about."
When Holden followed him up, he found Amos and Naomi already waiting. Naomi was leaning back with her hands behind her head, but Amos sat on the edge of a crash couch, both feet on the floor and his hands clenched into a doubled fist in front of him. His expression was still dark with anger.
"So, Jim," Alex said, walking over to another crash couch and dropping into it, "this ain't a good start."
She's looking stuff up about us, Amos said to no one in particular, his gaze still on the floor. Stuff she shouldn't know.
Holden knew what Amos meant. Monica's reference to Baltimore was an allusion to Amos's childhood as the product of a particularly nasty brand of unlicensed prostitution. But Holden couldn't admit he knew it. He himself only knew because of an overheard conversation. He had no interest in humiliating Amos further.
She's a journalist. They do background research, he said.
She's more than that, Naomi said. She's a nice person. She's charming and she's friendly, and every one of us on this ship wants to like her.
That's a problem, Holden said.
That's a big fucking problem, Amos said. I was on the Canterbury for a reason, Jim, Alex said.
His Mariner Valley drawl had stopped sounding silly and just seemed sad instead.
I don't need someone digging up my skeletons to air them out.
The Canterbury, the ice hauler they had all worked on together before the Eros incident, was a bottom-of-the-barrel job for those who flew for a living. It attracted people who'd failed down to the level of their incompetence, or those who couldn't pass the background checks a better job might require. Or, in his own case, those who had a dishonorable military discharge staining their record. After having served with his small crew for years, Holden knew it wasn't incompetence that had put any of them on that ship.
I know, he started.
Same here, Captain, Amos said. I got a lot of past in my past.
So do I, Naomi said.
Holden started to reply, then stopped when the import of her words hit him. Naomi was hiding something that had driven her to take a glorified mechanics job on the Canterbury. Well, of course she was. Holden hadn't wanted to think about it, but it was obvious. She was about the most talented engineer he'd ever met. He knew she had degrees from two universities and had completed her 3-year flight officer training in 2. She'd started her career on an obvious command track. Something had happened, but she'd never talked about what it had been. He frowned a question at her, but she stopped him with a tiny shake of her head. The fragility of their little family struck him full force. The paths that had pulled them all together had been so diverse, as improbable and unlikely as those kinds of things ever were, and the universe could just as easily take them apart. It left him feeling small and vulnerable and a little defensive.
Everyone remembers why we did this, right?
Holden asked.
The lockdown? Mars coming after the Rosinante?
We didn't have a choice, Naomi replied.
We know. We all agreed to take this job.
Amos nodded in agreement.
Alex said, No one's saying we shouldn't have taken the job. What we're saying is that you're the front man for this band.
Yes, Naomi said. You need to be so interesting that this documentary crew forgets all about the rest of us. That's your job for the rest of this flight. That's the only way this works.
No, Amos said, still not looking up. There is another way, but I've never tossed a blind man out an airlock. Don't know how I'd feel about that. Might not be fun.
Okay, Holden said, patting the air with his hands in a calming motion. I get it. I'll keep the cameras out of your faces as much as I can, but this is a long trip. Be patient. When we get to the ring, maybe they'll be tired of us and we can pawn them off on some other ship.
They were silent for a moment. Then Alex shook his head.
Well, he said, I think we just found the only thing that'll make me look forward to getting there.
Holden woke with a start, rubbing furiously at an itch on his nose. He had a half-remembered feeling of something trying to climb inside it. No bugs on the ship, so it had to have been a dream. The itch was real, though. As he scratched, he said, Sorry, bad dream or something, and patted the bed next to him. It was empty. Naomi must have gone to the bathroom. He inhaled and exhaled loudly through his nose several times, trying to get rid of the itchy sensation.